Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hello. Welcome to News from the Torah. Today is the 10th day of the Hebrew month of Tammuz, June 20th, 2021, and this week we will read the Torah portion of Balak. Hi, I'm Leah Aharoni, and it's great having you here. We've been having some interesting times here in Israel, but I would like to focus in on one specific area that this weekly portion is bringing for us, and that is, how do you view other people? How do you judge other people? We have a great example in this week's Torah portion of somebody by the name of Bilam who was brought out to curse the Jews. And that person, although being a prophet of God, had a choice of whether to follow God's word and look at the positives or to go against God's will and look at the negatives. And today we will discuss what exactly was Bilam's approach, how he was searching out for the faults, and why that was an important part of his mission to curse the Jewish people. We will also discuss how this approach of looking out for the negative, of searching the faults, of cursing others and looking at them with a negative eye, how that affects our own lives. Does this contribute to our happiness? Or maybe it does not. Maybe it actually makes us depressed. Maybe it actually spoils our own experience. And in the second and third part of the show, I would like to take these lessons that we are learning from Bilam and apply them to how the secular culture and especially the secular media has been portraying the Torah community, the ultra-Orthodox community. How by focusing in on all the little faults, all the ways that the Haredi community, the ultra-Orthodox community, does not align with the secular world, the secular culture has been painting hateful stereotypes that is simply not true. We will share a lived experience of a person from this community, and we'll also share some statistics for you to get a real and honest perspective what it is like to live the Torah lifestyle. Stay tuned. We will have much more of this right after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Zapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back. So this week's Torah portion, Balak, tells us a really interesting story. The king of Moab, by the name of Balak, for whom this Torah portion is mentioned, was scared of the Jews parked at his border. The Jews were just trying to get to the land of Israel, actually, minding their own business and asking the nations around to just let them pass and get into the land of Israel. They weren't into starting a war. But the nations around the land of Israel would not let the Jews pass. And some of them were just being hostile, and some of them would just actually go out and start a war with the Jews. But the Jews were just trying to pass, and they were treated as an aggressor. Yeah, that sounds familiar. So Balak, who was not confident of his military ability, went out and found a non-Jewish prophet by the name of Bilam. And he paid Bilam a bunch of money to come over and curse the Jews so that Balak could actually fight the Jews and win over them. Now, when Balaam asked God if he is allowed to curse the Jews, God told him, leave the Jews alone. Don't get involved. They don't need your curses. They don't need your blessings. But Balaam hated the Jews just as much as Balak did. So he went out and joined Balak and tried to curse the Jews. What was his strategy? He would come very, very close near the Jewish camp and look at one little isolated part of the camp. And looking at the camp from different isolated points, he was hoping to find something ugly in the camp that he would be able to curse. God, of course, got involved and turned Balak's curses into blessings. And after three such instances, Balak got fed up and told Balaam, just leave, go. But before Balaam left, although he was not able to curse the Jewish people, he gave Balak and his friends a piece of advice. You want to defeat the Jews, there's one way to do so. Promiscuity. Get your girls to go after the Jewish men. And promiscuity is something that God hates. And if Jewish men are involved in promiscuity, then for sure you'll be able to defeat them. But I want to go back to Balak's methodology, to his way of cursing the Jews. I would say just say that what Balak did was to zero in on this one part of the camp to find something ugly and not look at things in context. Now, have you ever noticed that you can walk into a room with a tall ceiling and all the hundreds of tiles on the ceiling will be right in their place? But if there's this one tile that's missing or is not on straight, you'll notice it right away. Your eyes will go there. Or if you can think of a friend wearing this beautiful outfit, but maybe there's this one stain somewhere on the outfit and you'll notice it. Or somebody created an amazing meal for you, but this one thing is missing. And right away, your eyes go there. Or your child has been behaving beautifully the whole afternoon. And then one slip up and you get mad at them. Yes, we're neurologically wired to go for the missing piece. We're neurologically wired to notice what is missing. We're neurologically wired to notice what is wrong. And this is antithetical to the Torah's perspective. When you look for one deficiency, you will always find it because nothing is perfect and everything is a mixed bag. So Balaam's methodology, Balaam's approach was to go after that one deficiency, to find it, to focus, to zero in, to blow it out of proportion, and then to curse the Jewish people based on that one deficiency and tell God, here, look at them. See how bad they are? Look at what they did right here. And that would be the source of his curse. And he tried it one place and he couldn't find it. He tried it in a different place and he couldn't find it. He tried it in a third place and he couldn't find it. And I think it's a very important lesson for all of us because, like I said, you can always find a deficiency. When you look at deficiencies, when you search out faults, you always get a wrong perception. Because real way to look at things in the broad perspective. Yes, maybe that one tile is missing, but there are 100 other tiles that are in place. And yes, maybe your kid misbehaved for 5 minutes, but she behaved really well for 5 hours. And yes, maybe somebody made a meal for you and forgot this one dish, but they made 10 other dishes for you. So we have a choice where to place our attention. We can place our attention at the things that are missing, the things that are bad, or we can place our attention at the things that are good, and the things that are going the way they should be. And that will absolutely shape our experience. Now, I would say just say that because Balaam was looking for faults, and he was looking places he shouldn't be looking, and he was literally searching out faults in places he shouldn't be doing, he became blind in one eye. And when you're blind in one eye, what you're missing is perspective. Everything looks flat. There is no perspective. And this is exactly what happens to people who systematically and habitually look for faults. They lose perspective and they become blinded to reality. They don't see half the reality. And in our modern language, that's called confirmation bias. Actually, the smarter somebody is, the better ability they have to find all the right reasons to support their claim. Their brilliance allows them to find all the reasons and to take all the facts and to twist and spin all the facts to confirm their bias. But what really happens is they're blinded to reality. And as they're looking to confirm their bias and as they're looking out for faults, what they're doing is they're missing half the picture. They're missing the beautiful half of the picture. And that really shapes their internal experience, because we all live in our subjective experience of an objective reality. Let me say that once again. Nobody lives in objective reality. We all live in our subjective experience of objective reality. This is something Kierkegaard, a Dutch philosopher from 300 years ago, said. And this is very consistent with how the Torah looks at the world. Yes, there is an objective reality, but none of us see it. Physically, we look at the world with a 120-degree field of vision. You can only see with your eyes 120 degrees of a 360-degree reality. That means we need two other perspectives to actually make up a whole and holistic worldview. So we all see only part of the picture. Now we have a choice. What part of the picture do we want to concentrate on? Do we want to concentrate on the good? Do we want to concentrate on the bad? And whatever we concentrate on is the experience we live in. So once again, if you walk into your house and you see your kids played nicely and they ate and they had fun together, and yes, they also made a mess. So you can look at the mess that they created and then get angry at them and be annoyed with them, and then you will live with the annoyance. Or you can congratulate them on being such good siblings and playing nicely for a few hours and feeding each other and making all those amazing things they did for each other. And then you will be happy and you will live in a happy experience. And of course, afterwards, you can also ask them to clean up after themselves. And this is true in everything. If you can literally have the angel of God standing in front of you and not notice, which is what happened to Bilam. He had the angel of God standing in front of him, and instead of talking to the angel of God, he was looking at his donkey, not listening to him, and having a consultation with the donkey. So the donkey could see the angel of God, but Bilam couldn't. The Talmud in the teachings of the fathers juxtaposes Bilam with Abraham. And the Talmud teaches us that there are three qualities that make somebody be like Abraham or be like Bilam. And it really all depends on what's inside of you. So what are the three qualities that make somebody like Abraham? It's a good eye, humility, and being happy with what you have. And what are the three qualities that make somebody like Bilam? It is the evil eye, haughtiness, and greediness. Somebody who has an evil eye is haughty and greedy, is always looking at other people negatively. He's always searching out what's wrong with the others. He's always searching out what do the others have that I want. He's always finding fault with the others, because when we find fault with others, we can prop ourselves up and feel like we're better. But Abraham had the good eye, and he was always happy with what he had. So when you're happy with what you have, you're also happy with what other people have. And he had humility, he was modest. He always looked at other people and thought, what else that's good I can do for other people. And while it seems that somebody like Bilam would be more successful in this world, the rabbis of the Talmud actually tell us the opposite. The students of Abraham, those that have the good eye, those that come to the world with humility, and those that are happy with their lot, not only do they have a better lot in the world to come, but ironically, they live a better physical life in this world. And people who are like Bilam, who are always thinking that they're better than others, who are always greedy, who are looking at others with a negative eye, those people not only are they killing their spiritual life, they're also spoiling their physical experience in this very world. And with this in mind, I think it will be helpful for all of us to take some perspective and be very careful about how we judge other people, other cultures, other religions, other societies. And after the break, I would like to talk to you about the perception of the ultra-Orthodox community in the media and on TV shows, how by focusing in on everything that is wrong, they've taken the Balaam approach to creating stereotypes about the Torah community. So stay tuned and we'll discuss it right after these messages.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country. From Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
It's so easy to hate the other when you don't know anything about the other. It's so easy to hate the other when you concentrate on a small piece of the existence without taking in a bigger picture and understanding anything about their lifestyle. Last week, Rabbi Daniel Katz, who is the founder of the Elevation Project, a well-known Torah and meditation teacher, posted a post about his experience in the Hasidic community. There are so many stereotypes about the Hasidic community that I wanted to share this post just for you to hear about one person's experience in this community and his outlook on the community. It might give you food for thought. So here it is. There's something I need to get off my chest. I'm an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Haredi Jew. This is Rabbi Katz. I live in Jerusalem in an area that is exclusively ultra-Orthodox Haredi. Haredi means ultra-Orthodox. For street after street, suburb after suburb, for miles and miles. In all of these neighborhoods where the roads are blocked off and no cars drive on Shabbos, each black hat-wearing family has many, many children and literally no TVs. I personally only ever wear black and white clothes. My wife only dresses in Hasidic level of modesty. And my boys and girls all attend mainstream Haredi Hasidic schools where the main language is Yiddish. My kids don't have a smartphone, nor have they ever been on the internet at all, period. They don't know what social media is, and they've never seen a movie, not even Disney animation. Having lived exclusively immersed in this culture for the last 21 years, I think I'm sufficiently qualified and well-researched enough to state that the consistent depiction of Haredim and Torah Judaism by mainstream media, from Netflix to the Daily News, is somewhere between delusional slander and the literal equivalent of racism. If you consider yourself less close-minded than how you imagine we ultra-Orthodox to be, then permit me to share a few personal details about my family and other families in our neighborhood to see how well your mental narrative matches up to reality. Besides learning Torah each day, most of the men in our neighborhood work full or part-time. Many women in our area work. Some even manage their own businesses or companies. These are not special or quote-unquote liberated women. It is so normal here, it's not even a discussion point. My wife is a full-time mother by choice, who despite attending an Ivy League college, finds it a profound and meaningful thing to dedicate her life to. If she didn't, she'd go to get a job. Mind you, she also attends Torah classes each week, works out with both a female fitness coach and a religious Pilates instructor, writes and edits articles for a couple of global websites and magazines, and personally mentors a number of women. None of this is seen as unusual. Kids in our community go to Torah schools where they learn, surprise, Torah. They're fluent in three languages from a young age, and the boys even read and understand a fourth, Aramaic. All the kids learn grammar, math, and science. Weekly after-school activities have included music, violin, drums, piano, taekwondo, swimming, arts, woodworking, and robotics. The girls' school teaches tools of emotional intelligence. The principal of the boys' school doesn't hesitate to refer kids to occupational therapy if needed. I practice meditation with my children multiple times each week. None of our kids think that the world is literally 6,000 years old. They devour books about science and think it's cool. They know dinosaurs existed and don't find that existentially threatening. They have a telescope with which they love to watch the stars. The women in my family, like the men, only dress modestly according to ultra-Orthodox standards. The girls don't find this bothersome or oppressive. They aren't taught that beauty is bad. They're certainly not taught to hate their bodies, God forbid. Each morning when they get dressed, they're as happily into their own fashion and looking pretty as any secular girl is. They just have a different sense of fashion than secular culture dictates. The local Haredi rabbis we receive guidance from are deep, warm, sensitive, supportive, and emotionally intelligent. If they weren't, we wouldn't go to them. My boys assume they will grow up to learn Torah as much as they want to, and then when they're ready, get a good job or learn a profession to support whatever lifestyle they choose. My girls assume they'll be wives and mothers, which they can't wait for, but they're also warmly encouraged to train in whatever other profession they desire. My 9-year-old daughter, chatting with her friend in the living room, just commented, "I want to be a mother and a teacher and an artist." Her friend replied, "I'm going to be a ballet teacher." All options are on the table and the future seems bright. We love living in modern Israel, feel proud and blessed to be here, and frequently count and celebrate its blessings. Everyone in my area votes, sometimes not even for Haredi parties, and pay taxes. And they are expensive. As a Haredi person, I'm glad we have Haredi representation in the government. They don't always love or approve how the Haredi politicians act or what they choose to represent. For the record, I'm equally dubious about the secular politicians as well. While I don't spend time in Tel Aviv, I do have a few close Haredi entrepreneur friends who have founded high-tech startups there and are, thank God, doing very well. We don't hate all non-religious people. Our kids don't throw stones at passing cars on Shabbat. I doubt they even know anyone who would do that or think that's okay. We frequently talk about the Torah value of caring for and being compassionate towards everyone. As a family, we proactively try to find ways to judge others favorably, even those who throw stones at passing cars on Shabbat. We invite all men of religious and secular Jews to join our Shabbat meals each week, and the kids are open, happy, and confident to welcome everyone. And no, we're not Chabad. One of the main reasons for having such guests at our table is to teach the kids this lesson. But we would technically be classified as right-wing, and we don't at all buy the modern Palestinian narrative, quote-unquote. We certainly don't hate all Arabs, nor do we have any desire to expel them all from the land. We warmly welcome anyone seeking to dwell here with us in peace. We're pained and saddened to see the suffering and loss of life of all innocent Arab families and children, as would any decent human being. Of the few local families I know whose kids no longer identify as religious, none at all chose to disown their kids. The very thought in such lovingly family-dedicated communities is hard to imagine. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying it's not as common as it's made out. Rather, these families have tirelessly, profoundly, compassionately committed to maintaining any connection with their children, and to emphasize that, no matter what, family is the most important thing, because it is. We aren't just living our life blindly, dogmatically following empty religious rules. Rather, we're frequently engaged with and exploring and discussing Torah's richness, depth, and meaning. Our kids honestly love learning Torah, praying and doing mitzvot, performing commandments. They're visibly excited about Shabbat and festivals. This lifestyle is no way oppressive or burdensome for them. If you suggest that to them, they'd laugh and think you are crazy. We Haredim are normal people. We laugh, we cry, we buy too much IKEA furniture, and we struggle with all of the life's daily ups and downs, just like the rest of you. Some of our communities are more healthy and balanced. Some are less. some of our people are warmer and nicer and more open, and some are more closed, dogmatic, and judgmental. Some of our leaders are noble and understanding, and some are quite frankly idiots, just like in any secular neighborhood in the world too. But having grown up living a secular lifestyle myself, and today being Haredi by choice, I can testify that in these communities there is generally a greater and more tangible sense of well-being, warmth, tranquility, connection, and meaning. We'll love and feel blessed to be living this life, and wouldn't want any other. If this description of Haredi life is hard to swallow, be careful not to push back with the often used defenses like, "Well, you're just an exception to the rule. You're just American Haredi." Or, "You're a Balei Tshuva, you chose to become Haredi." "Well, I know a bunch of Haredim, they aren't like that at all." Because the truth is, while there might be many Haredim who aren't like what I described above, it is still an accurate description of literally hundreds of thousands of Haredim in Israel and the U.S., a decent portion of all Haredim in the world, which is my very point. How come you never see this significant Haredi demographic represented in the media, television series, or the news? How come we mostly see the darkest and most problematic cliches instead? And finally, if all the facts I've listed above about our communities are hard for you to accept as true, then perhaps the image you have in your head about Haredim is laced based on fact and reality and more based on stereotypes, fear, hate, and discrimination, like any other form of prejudice in the world. Care to prove me wrong? Well, you're welcome to come argue it out with me and my family at our Shabbat table on Friday night. It will be a joy and an honor to have you. So this text was written by Rabbi Daniel Katz of Jerusalem, like I mentioned in the beginning. He has been living in the Haredi community for 20 years, and this has been his experience. And I thought it important to share it this day with you so that we could challenge the regularly accepted stereotypes, which are, like we said at the beginning, are just a way to zero in on some deficiency and black out the context, black out the good and the beautiful that is in this community, the standard fare of all the Bilams in the world. We all have negative experiences and run-ins with different communities from time to time, but basing our whole judgment in that community on those select experiences is not helpful or productive or true. And it's certainly not a way to portray these communities in the media. Let's look for context. Let's look for perspective. Let's appreciate each other more with an open mind and an open heart. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
Welcome back. So in the previous segment, I read you a text written by Rabbi Daniel Katz about his experience in the Haredi community. I don't know how you received it, but if your exposure to the Torah lifestyle has been mostly from the media and TV shows, it was probably hard to swallow. And many people could react by saying that this is one person's experience and that that experience is atypical. I think it helps to understand that there are close to 3 or 4 million Orthodox Jews in the world, out of which almost 2 million are what are called ultra-Orthodox or Haredi. And this is a very diverse group of people. Some of them come from the Muslim countries and known as Sephardim, and they have a very different culture than those Jews coming from Europe. Some of them are Hasidic, and inside the Hasidic world, there are many different groups, each one with its own culture and set of rules. And then some of them are American or European, and they live their life differently than Israeli Haredim do. So it's a diverse group of people, but I would like to share something that's more about statistics and less about personal experience. Because here in Israel, we have the statistics about how the Haredi community lives. And if you look at the statistics, you will see that they also paint a very different picture for what is usually believed and presented in the media. Before I share these statistics, I just want to make it very clear that I'm not myself sociologically Haredi. We do live an observant Torah lifestyle, but we do not see ourselves as part of the Haredi community. The many cultural differences and sociological differences. So while I have the insider access in this community, I work with it very closely for over 10 years and have taught and trained people in every stripe of this community. I also have an outsider perspective. So with that in mind, please let me share some statistics. And these have been called by the Israeli Democracy Institute, a non-Haredi body that actually monitors the Haredi lifestyle in Israel every year and puts out a report. And it has seen a steady progress in how the Haredi community is integrating it into the Israeli society. Now, I want to make it very clear that unlike Western society, for the Haredim, the main value and the main priority is maintaining a Torah lifestyle that includes a very large amount of time devoted to learning Torah full-time in what is known as yeshiva or a kollel. Yeshiva is where men learn, and a kollel is where men learn after they get married. Many Haredi men and many Haredi families choose to learn full-time, long-term. It is their way to gain mastery of the text, and also make sure that there are enough people who are very well versed in the Torah, and that takes dedication and long years of learning. It is not a lifestyle that is appropriate for all people, but it is appropriate for some people. And if we consider the fact that there are 17 million Jews in the world and only about 120,000 people studying in yeshiva, and only half of those are people who are studying long-term after they're married into their late 20s and 30s, it's a very small number. Once again, perspective really helps. So here are some statistics about the Haredi community that I would like to share with you. And they really fly in the face of all the stereotypes. So myth number one, Haredim only study. Well, this is not true, they don't. Like I said, there are 17 million Jews in the world. There are about 1.2 million Haredim in Israel. And there are only about 120 who study in yeshiva or a kollel. That's 1 in 10 Haredim, and that's less than 1 in 100 Jews. Now, out of these 120,000, 85,000 are young yeshiva students. They're people in their late teens, early 20s, and there are only about 35,000 men who study in yeshiva long-term after they get married. Not overwhelming numbers. Myth number two, Haredim don't work. Yes, they do. Over 60% of Haredim work. That's about 15 percentage points less than other Jews in Israel, but that doesn't matter. The majority of Haredim work. Haredi women work on par with their secular friends, and Haredi employment rates are up by 30% in the past 15 years. Number three, Haredim live off of the state. No, they don't. An average single yeshiva student does not get a dime from the state. His yeshiva will get a subsidy of about 400 shekels, $130 a month, to cover his dorm fees. That's one-third of what the state would invest into an Israeli student. Yes, even a student in liberal arts that will not create any kind of productive outcome for the state. The state will still sponsor that student three times what it would sponsor a Haredi student. And actually, students who study the Talmud in the university will also be sponsored three times what a yeshiva student will be sponsored for learning that same exact Talmud in the yeshiva. Now, a married Haredi student gets a princely stipend, $220 a month. This is what the state of Israel is willing to invest into somebody who is learning the Torah. So $220 a month is really not a lot. What Haredim do get, just like a lot of the Israelis, are child stipends. The Israeli government pays each family about 180 shekels, or about $60 a month for every child. So Haredim obviously get it, and yes, they have six kids or so on average in a family, but this is a payment that is made to all Israelis. Now, keeping in mind that Haredim make about 14% of the population, the state paid out to Haredi families are 1 billion shekels out of the 500 billion shekels national budget. Yes, that's 0.2%. 0.2% is what Haredim get, while they're 14% of the population. So this myth about Haredim living off of the government is simply not true. And these last findings about the share of the Haredi investment as a share of the national budget is not mine. It was made by the Globe's economic magazine. Haredim don't get an education. Yes, they do. So first of all, Haredim get a Torah education. If you've never studied the Talmud, you need to understand that it gives you the legal understanding and the legal mind better than any law school ever will. I'm watching my 20-year-old law school student daughter develop the case law, logical reasoning, and text analysis skills that my son has been gaining from studying the Talmud since he is 10. In 2007, Martin Pritikin researched this issue of how studying the Talmud gives you the law understanding and is on par of learning in law school. And you can look up that research to understand how learning the Talmud is an amazing education. But if you look at Haredim going to colleges, that number has grown to actually by 150% in the past decade. Once again, Haredim make about 16% of the population and about 4% of college students. However, what most people don't know is that the Haredi community has its own college tracks. For example, most young women go to what is called a seminar. It's a high school, and after they finish their 12th grade, they have options inside the school to continue for vocational training. And these high school seminars after 12th grade provide trainings in computer science and accounting in different trades. So many girls will not go to college, but they will get an education, a post-high school education, if it's in computers and accounting, in event planning, or any trade inside their own school. Haredim are poor is another well-known myth. So it is true that most Haredi families have lower income than everybody else, than the mainstream. And that is about 2/3 of the average Israeli family. This is what the Haredi family's budget usually is. However, those numbers are growing. And for most Haredim, it is a choice to live a simpler lifestyle. Haredim spend on average 15% less on family expenses than other people. How? By budgeting, vacationing in Israel, and not going abroad. Have an extensive network of mutual assistance in the community where people can help each other by lending each other the necessary equipment. And once again, it's a choice. Haredi community places a premium on Torah study instead of going out to make more money, which is the primary Western value these days. Another myth is Haredim don't contribute to society. Well, that certainly is not true. Israeli society has many, many, many nonprofit organizations, and many of them have been established and operated by the Haredi community. Organizations like Hatzalah, Ambulance Service, Zaka, who come out to a scene of any car crash or terror incident to pick up the bodies and make sure that they're buried in a dignified manner. Yatsira and Ezer Mitzion, which provide medical assistance and medical equipment to anybody who needs free of charge. If you've ever walked into an Israeli hospital, you will meet a staff of Haredi volunteers working around making sure that people have their needs met. They'll come out to play music and have medical clowns to cheer people up. Haredi volunteer at twice the rates of their secular brothers and sisters. 40% of Haredim volunteer on a regular basis for life. That is compared to only 20% of secular Israelis. And Haredim give much, much more to charity. 90% of Haredim contribute money to charity regularly, as opposed to just over half of secular Israelis. And despite having lower income, 2/3 of Haredim will give over 500 shekels a year to charity, versus about 20% of the secular. And in the end, like we said in the beginning, if somebody wants to live their bias, no amount of facts will change their mind. We'll all have choices to love or to hate, to look at the positive or the negative, to judge people as stereotypes or as individuals. Our choices say much more about ourselves than about those that we judge. We should really judge carefully. Have a great week, and I'll see you next week with more news from the Torah.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.home page, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.